Cheerweed Solutions TechCast for Friday, August 1st, 2008. My guest today is Toby DePasquale from Invite Media. I spoke with Toby last week about distributed computing using Hadoop. We start by discussing how Google started its page ranking algorithms and how, over time, the traditional processing methods just couldn't keep pace with their vast data needs. We review the MapReduce algorithm and how it powers Google's current processing across their vast server networks. Then we discuss Hadoop, which is an open-source Java-based implementation of MapReduce, as well as some helper projects such as the Pig query language. Finally, we discuss the impact of Amazon's Elastic Computing Cloud on running Hadoop and other large-scale data processing engines. This is a long one, but Toby is a great presenter, and it's well worth listening to. Enjoy the show. I'm joined today by Toby DePasquale of Invite Media. How you doing?
How you doing? Good.
So Toby and I were chatting before we started the podcast a little bit about MapReduce. That's our topic today. Toby, why don't we talk a little bit first about Invite Media in general, what you guys do?
Well, we're currently in stealth mode, but we are doing advertising optimization technology for larger agencies and larger advertisers and networks. We're working with some of the cutting-edge exchanges that are coming out now, and it's going to be a really interesting force multiplier for the advertising industry as a whole. I'm pretty excited about it. It's good stuff.
So now you worked in the past for places like Commerce 360, Symantec, Turntide, and such.
Yeah, I was the chief architect at Commerce 360 there, mm-hmm. and they actually did something sort of similar to what Invite Media is doing now, except in the paid search, the SEM space. Prior to that, I worked at Symantec for 2.5 years because they had acquired my previous company, Turntide. Where we built the world's first anti-spam router. That was a whole lot of fun. That was the most fun I had I've ever had professionally. That was a great time.
So now you detected email messages coming across and detected them as spam and knocked them out?
Yeah, the trick with that was it was an actual wire-level router. So we didn't block or quarantine messages like a traditional mail filter would, but the router would actually apply traffic shaping to the incoming connections, and so provide a real economic disincentive for spammers to stop spamming a particular network. We actually had customers that would turn it off, and then the spam wouldn't come back right away, mm-hmm. and that's how you knew it was working.
All right, so now you've got this you've got this work at Invite Media. You're doing work with large amounts of data.
Yeah, at Invite Media, we have a lot of logs. So we're serving ads, right? We're mm-hmm. serving impressions for ads on a lot of different publisher websites, a lot of different networks. And so we have a ton of data coming in very rapidly. And the trick for us, because we're an ad optimization engine, we're trying to make it easier to optimize and also provide that optimization capability in the first place. We need to be able to crunch those logs and provide real, you know, business intelligence very quickly. And there aren't many tools that are available today that can help you out in that regard. One is Hadoop, and you know, Google has their own thing that they actually invented. Hadoop is a sort of a clone of that infrastructure, but yeah, the that ends up being the sort of premier way to do this sort of work these days. It's very interesting.
And I guess, you know, prior to that, a lot of people would think that's kind of a data analysis, data warehousing kind of process, right? You load a whole bunch of data into a big database and start doing SQL queries or bitmap indexes or something like that.
Well, so you can do that still. We mm-hmm. we actually use a data warehouse as well. But the data warehouse that we use is actually for answering customer queries. Mm-hmm. So if they want to do discovery and whatnot. So it's bulk loaded after the fact.
Right.
More importantly, the analysis we do to provide the optimization can't really be done in that regard. It's a little bit too amorphous. Mm-hmm. We're working with a statistics team at Wharton, and they want to be able to ask the questions that they want to ask. They don't necessarily want to be constrained by the warehouse star schema,
right?
Things of that nature. So we need a little bit more flexible and more efficient platform for that. You know, data warehouses are notoriously hard to configure and maintain, as you're probably aware.
Yes, as we all know.
Yeah.
I'll just take another large 5 terabyte drive, please. You
know? Yeah, exactly right.
Oh, wait, it failed. two or three days down. All right, so let's take it down to Google, right? So what, about 97, 96, whatever, Google had a problem, right?
They did. They had an even bigger problem at that time than we did. Remember, that was 10 years ago. So
right.
Larry Page had come up with the PageRank algorithm. His essential innovation was that he wanted to treat web pages as academic papers, right? In an academic circle, it's commonly a big thing to cite the references in a particular paper, and so the strength of the paper is actually directly tied to the number of references it gets and the number of references those papers get and whatnot. So it becomes this network of references. They actually have a name for this called the Erdős number, which is the level of separation you have from Paul Erdős, the father of modern network theory. Right?
And if it's six, then you know you're hooked in, right?
Six
degrees of. Yeah.
Some people actually put their Erdős number on their curriculum vitae, so that's a pretty big thing.
In the search world, that probably matters.
Yeah, yeah. So, but Larry came up with this algorithm, and then so obviously you needed a place to test it. And being broke grad students at Stanford, you know, they didn't really have access to a lot of money. And this is this is like in the bubble, but at that time, search was felt to be a commodity.
Right.
In fact, it was not anything people were really concentrating on.
Lycos and all the other...
AltaVista,
Yahoo, right.
Yeah. They didn't really concentrate on that because they felt their value was in portal and media and things like that.
Right.
So Larry and Sergey would literally go down to the loading docks of Stanford, and when the guys were throwing away old machines, I'd be like, no, hold up, we'll take those.
Give me that Altair 1000 now.
Yeah, exactly, right? And they, there's this famous picture on the internet you can find of the first eight machines they ever had sitting under and on top of and to the side of Larry's desk, running google.stanford.edu at that time. And, but from the very beginning, they knew they had big data to deal with. And search is one of the most computationally expensive problems that you can engage in. Because essentially, Larry's algorithm is taking this may be a little technical, but it's essentially taking the eigenvector of the internet, which is of the World Wide Web, which is
how many links are there to your particular website URL anywhere else on the internet.
Right, but you're following that graph, right? So
right.
It's a huge matrix linear algebra problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's actually a $25 billion linear algebra.
And it's worked
problem.
Well for them. Yeah.
Yeah, it works out great.
Mm-hmm.
But the they needed to deal with multiple machines, multiple commodity machines from the very start. And so they came up with this system called Big Files, which later morphed into the Google File System.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a distributed parallel file system, very much unlike others like a Lustre or a Oracle's Cluster File System. They definitely – one key thing is that they don't work in the kernel. The files themselves are the blocks of the files are actually files themselves on the regular disk file system.
Okay.
And the block size is huge compared to a traditional file system. Traditional file system, a block size is going to be 512, maybe 1024 bytes, right?
Mm-hmm.
The block size in GFS is 64 megabytes.
Right, okay.
So it's designed from the very beginning for gigantic files, multi-gigabyte files, and designed for streaming reads, right? Because it turns out the disk is a lot slower than memory,
right.
And it's getting slower in proportion all the time. So treating disk like tape is actually much better for your overall performance because disks can still provide pretty good throughput when you read sequentially, right? It's when you go to random access that they really just fall down.
Yeah.
So GFS was built with those in mind, and then they realized, well, now we have all of this data laying around. What are we going to do with it? How can we process it? Prior to the invention of MapReduce, by Jeff Dean and Sanjay Gemawat, they had written a bunch of custom algorithms to do their search engine ranking, and that was not tenable.
I'm sure not.
Yeah, it was very hard to maintain, as you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, custom C++ and all
right.
this sort of pipelining and everything. The introduction of the MapReduce framework really made that a lot smoother. originally, no, I'm told, I don't know if this is true, but originally they took that whole thing and they turned it into about 20 MapReduce jobs in a pipeline.
Isn't that funny?
And so there's a lot more now, I'm told, but I don't know the exact number, but yeah.
So we're kind of walking around MapReduce.
Yeah.
Google
MapReduce is the crown jewel.
Yeah, it's the topic of the day, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, going back to 2004-ish, Jeffrey Dean and Sanjay Gimawat, mm-hmm. They put together this white paper, right,
yeah.
on the MapReduce concept.
It was actually an academic paper. It was mm-hmm. published I think it was published in SOSPI, maybe,
mm-hmm.
or one of the big conferences on this topic. But the essential innovation behind MapReduce is really clever. They took a little piece of data processing from the functional programming world, from Lisp in particular,
mm-hmm.
and they said that the map operation in Lisp is a function that takes as its input a function and also a list of arguments, and then it will apply that function to each of its arguments and then yield the mutated list as its return value. So you'll get, you know, if you pass in a list of five arguments, you'll get the same five arguments back out. They'll just have the function applied to them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can give it a function like +1, and it will add 1 to each element in the list, or a square or square root or something like that, and you'll get that mutated list as a result. Turns out that this operation is embarrassingly parallel.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to split up.
It's very elemental, right?
Exactly, because all you need to know is the function and the one input you're working on right now. You don't need to care about any other input in the list. It doesn't matter what order they're done in. It just doesn't matter. Mathematically, the operation is both associative and commutative, so it's what we call embarrassingly parallel.
Mm-hmm.
So they took that and they took this reduce concept, where reduce is a little bit harder. I think that's actually a bad name. I like the Haskell name better. They call it fold.
Okay.
So what a reduce is you take this function takes three arguments, and it takes a function, it takes an initializer value, what's called an accumulator usually, mm-hmm. and it takes a list, right? And so what this is actually going to do is it's going to fold down the list. So it's going to take the first value off, you know, apply it to both the accumulator and that first value, and it's going to put the result of that back in the accumulator. Then it's going to work on the second one the same way. It's going to take the second one and the accumulator and put that back into the accumulator based on the function you pass in. So what this actually does is this turns a list into a scalar, a single value. Or a smaller list,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, this is not parallelizable, but through some very clever work that they had done, they had made this sort of more parallelizable than it really would be. Basically, they took the key space of the outputs of the map, and they had cut it up such that all of the particular keys in a particular range would go to a single machine.
Okay.
So for that particular key range, it was sequential. But you could have multiple reduced machines working simultaneously on different key ranges and not affect the output of the entire system.
Okay, so if, for example, you're taking ranking of pages,
mm-hmm.
and maybe you're grouping by some sort of category. I don't know if this is a correct way to apply it. But you're in your reduce, you're folding up and counting and figuring out a list of account by category, essentially.
Yeah, one great example, one of the canonicals examples of MapReduce would be like actually building a search index,
mm-hmm.
right? So you would start off with this big pile of documents, of HTML documents. And so what you would do is you'd extract the text that was in the page, and also the links to the page. So the links to the page, you know, would then become the data. And the text would actually then become the key. So what you would do is that each mapper would take one of these documents, you know, and work on it. So it would take the HTML document and the text, and it would extract the link in the text, and then the text associated with that, and it would yield a list of two things, right? The word, mm-hmm. and then the link associated with that word. So then it would yield this big list, and then it would send those words off to the reducers. So the reducer would get all the words in a particular range. So every instance of the word Google or disambiguate would all end up on the same machine. And so
okay.
what then the reducer would do is take that whole big list of links associated with that particular word, and fold it up into a single entry where the word, let's say disambiguate, was then paired with all of the links that were associated with that word.
Mm-hmm.
So then on the search side, when you go to search, it's more complicated than this, but this is sort of the basic idea.
Right.
When you go to search, you type in these words, and then they look up the words. They look up all the words, and they pull back these lists of URLs, and they map them. They merge them together. They do a set intersection, and then they look at those URLs as the results for the query.
Okay.
Right? That's not actually what they do, but that's
a very simplified version of it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So Google had built this engine, MapReduce engine.
Mm-hmm.
They built kind of a language to process it, I guess?
Yeah, they...
query tool, so to speak?
The MapReduce framework is actually written in C++, and they did make some... the only thing you actually have to write as a MapReduce developer is the actual map function and the reduce function. There's some boilerplate code, but that's largely the same for every job.
Mm-hmm.
So you really don't have to do much of anything because the parallelization, the job scheduling, the re-execution in the face of failures, all of that is actually handled by the MapReduce framework itself. You don't need to do anything as a developer except write the map function and the reduce function, which is really quite nice. However, map and reduce together, you can only sort of do so many things with a single map and a single reducer. So a lot of times you want to chain these things together to produce sort of more complicated output, maybe something similar to a join or, complicated sorting, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys inside Google, actually, Rob Pike, who, if you don't know, he's the guy who I believe he invented the pipe.
Oh, in UX?
Yeah.
He's my hero.
He was at Bell Labs back in that day with Kernighan and Ritchie and Thompson and all those guys, right?
Okay.
He's a
luminary.
He's a legend, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Pike wrote the Sawzall paper, and the Sawzall is a language that's sort of like a awk, I guess, a distributed awk.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they characterize it. And it's used for extracting patterns. But this language actually will compile down to MapReduce jobs. So you can write in this very short, very focused language, and it will compile down to the MapReduce jobs that will get the job done, potentially more than one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more limited in scope than MapReduce, but it's much faster if all you want to do is extract, big pieces of the web. And remember, working on levels of terabytes and things. So these jobs, they still only maybe take a couple minutes to run. It's very efficient because they're running on thousands of machines concurrently.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So the rest of the world probably didn't have any clue about this for a long time, right?
Yeah. In 2004, they had published the MapReduce paper, which was probably the most seminal paper in data processing in the past 10 years.
It was a watershed moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And prior to that, the GFS paper was out the previous year, but it was really interesting, but we're like, okay, what?
Big files on a network, congratulations.
Yeah, what do you do with that, But the MapReduce paper really put it into focus, and
mm-hmm.
it actually made the GFS paper even better because of what it was.
It's a great application that's using it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And but yeah, you're right, nobody had that outside of Google until a guy named Doug Cutting, who was the founder of the Lucene project and the Nutch project, search engine projects, he figured, why should Google have all the fun? So he started...
published a paper.
They did. No, and those things are not patented.
Right.
There actually is one small piece of the Google file system that is under patent application. But that's not really important to get into.
Right. It's kind of fascinating that they didn't patent that and they wanted to give it away.
None of their stuff is patented. If at that time, if you were to look at Google's patents at that time, they basically had two types of patents. One was on advertising techniques, which makes a lot of sense.
Right.
Where they make 99% of their revenue.
Yeah.
And the other was on data center operations techniques, like cooling baffles, cabling systems, power systems.
So they could be more agile at ramping up servers than anybody else.
That's really Google's technical advantage, right? Because they are able to run big systems at scale for a cost that nobody else can match.
And there's a lot of data centers out there from Google, from my understanding, right? A number of them anyway?
The number that I have, and I don't know if it's right, is about 60 data centers so far. I mean, my guess is they have around 650,000 machines total. Google obviously won't confirm or deny any of those numbers, so it's all just a guess. But we know they have tons of machines.
That's a lot of TI-99s.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely...
Amazing.
Texas Instruments is doing good.
I'm telling you. All right, so now Doug Cutting built this MapReduce emulator or engine.
Well, he was trying to write... So he had done Lucene, which was a search engine platform for Java.
Right.
And a very good one. And so he then started Nutch, which was a distributed search engine platform so that you could do search over much bigger document bases and much faster, support much higher query loads and things. And he realized that the GFS and the MapReduce stuff would just fit in like chocolate and peanut butter with the stuff that he started doing. So he actually started rolling what was then called the DFS, the Distributed File System, and MapReduce into Nutch. And then later it was split out into a project of its own called Hadoop. And then in 2000, I think in late 2005, maybe, or early 2006, they actually, Yahoo actually hired Doug Cutting to come to Yahoo to work on Hadoop full-time. And as of mid-2006, they had 20 people working on it full-time. They probably have a lot more now. It's really a big thing at Yahoo. They've gotten it running on over 14,000 machines in a single data center. So they're using it. They're porting their entire web search engine over to the Hadoop infrastructure, and it's all written in Java. And there's basically two pieces to the Hadoop project as it exists today. There's HDFS, the Hadoop Distributed File System, which is similar to GFS in scope and functionality. So it's a file system for very large streaming files, right? And also the MapReduce side, which works very similarly to the Google MapReduce. I mean, all this stuff is from the Google playbook, you know, the papers that came out.
Mm-hmm.
So the those two pieces allow you to effectively replicate what Google has internally, you know, possibly not for the same cost, you know, economies of scale and all. But you can replicate the same programming environment, so you can make, you know, very large-scale distributed processing very easy for your developers because they only have to write these two functions. And because they are composable, you can reuse these, you know, over and over again in a lot of different jobs, which is really nice.
At Invite Media, you're using MapReduce, you're using Hadoop at this point.
Yeah, that's right. We do use it for log processing and for statistical analysis. I used it also at Commerce 360 for the same thing. Actually, at Symantec, I had written, before I had known Hadoop existed, I'd written my own little the GFS and MapReduce clone in Ruby. That was a sort of a failure because Ruby's GC model wasn't that good. But So I've been using it for a while, and it really works very well. I can't imagine doing these kinds of things without this framework because the log processing especially is just like I said earlier, chocolate and peanut butter. It's just so good for that particular job. Because typically when you process logs, you know, there's a ton of logs, but you only want to, you know, really operate on one log line at a time.
Right.
Typically, you know, most of the time, log lines are what we call idempotent. They don't relate to each other. You don't have to join them together, you know, things like that. So this model works fantastically for that, which is great.
Great. So I understand there's a query tool kind of like Sawzall called Pig.
Yeah, Yahoo came out last year with a language called Pig, which if Sawzall is kind of similar to awk, then Pig would be kind of similar to SQL, to SQL. And it is a higher level language that also will compile down to, you know, Hadoop MapReduce jobs. And it's quite nice. We're using it a lot. In fact, all of our stuff is actually in Pig at Invite Media. At Commerce 360, I'd previously written the raw MapReduce jobs, and that was, you know, simple, but it definitely is it's an order of magnitude simpler with Pig because you're really telling Pig exactly what you want to do. You're not actually even caring about the map and the reduce anymore. You're actually telling it much more closely what it is you want to get out, the order you want to get it out of the data, what you want it to look like.
So you're essentially almost in set theory in a way?
Yeah, it isn't it's not full relational calculus, but it's very close, and there is actually some talk about making it like fully SQL 99, right. Which
and then it would be a processing engine behind the scenes. You wouldn't have to think right. about the MapReduce in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, actually, what happens is that Pig will as it takes in commands, it will wait until you tell it to a store command,
mm-hmm.
and then once the store command is issued, it will take all those previous commands. Merge them together and compile them down to MapReduce jobs, and then at that point run the entire job on your Hadoop cluster. So it does wait until the storage command to fire off the job, which is actually nice because you can make a mistake and go back and
right.
and whatnot. And at the storage command, if you think about it, is actually the point of mutation,
mm-hmm.
and so that is the correct point at which to execute
right.
the job. Those are like the checkpoints,
mm-hmm.
in the execution.
I
so
gotcha.
Those are good.
Cool. So is there any other MapReduce implementation that you know of besides Hadoop and the MapReduce from Google?
Yeah, there's a few out there. There was one for Ruby called Starfish, but that one was actually backed up by Active Record and used a database as its store. So its author, Lucas Carlson, claims that it really worked out for him, but it isn't in the same vein as a real distributed MapReduce. So you wouldn't use it for the same things.
Right, and I did see it was on the server side, I believe. There were two papers on using Mule, if it was either Mule or Service Mix, one of the two of them, as an engine that they kind of sent jobs through the SOA platform to do a similar concept to MapReduce.
I hadn't actually seen
that. I'll show that in the show notes,
yeah,
actually.
Great, okay.
But, yeah, I didn't know of any others, so I was just kind of curious.
There's a few toy ones out there. Actually, there are more clones of GFS than there are of MapReduce. As far as I know, there's only one industrial-grade MapReduce, and that's Hadoop. There are several other file system sort of clones, the biggest of which is probably Cosmos's KFS. So their KFS is a GFS clone written in C++, so it's claimed to be faster than the Hadoop HDFS because that's written in Java. I have never personally used it. I don't know if it's better or not. I know it was hard to set up, and that's why I didn't use it. So other than that, I'm sure it's come a long way since then, though.
Right.
You know.
Okay.
But.
So then we talked about a little bit about Google's deployment of MapReduce using
right.
low-rent hardware and large data centers.
Right.
There's other options, too. You're using Amazon EC2?
That's right, yeah. In my estimation, Hadoop and EC2 go together extremely well because they do, really. I mean, it's
could it be the Elvis-like bananas?
I hate to keep using that terminology, but it's just, I mean, it just feels like to me that all these things are coming together, at the same time, and
yeah.
so it's like, oh, I have this huge, awesome force multiplier over here for distributed processing, but then I look at my data center and I still have the same old six boxes in the rack. But then,
yeah.
blam! Out of nowhere, here comes EC2.
We'll give you that.
In like the cavalry. Like, you want 500 machines? No problem.
Right.
You know, it's
we'll give you 500. Machines with
yeah.
the air quotes.
Hey, you know what? As far as we're concerned, they are machines. They
yeah.
don't really care. You know,
right.
They're as good as any other machine that you could get from a rack saver or a Dell or whatever. And you get them when you want them, and you turn them off when you don't, which is just fantastic.
Right. Now, not to make this a tutorial on Amazon EC2, just for the listeners, EC2 essentially lets you create virtual instances of machines.
That's right.
Fire them up, install software on them, and let them run for basically you're almost time sharing the VM.
Yeah, that's right. It EC2 stands for Elastic
Computing Cloud.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so what it is, it's an Amazon Web Service that allows you to register, a sort of a disk image. Which is your operating system right now? Linux is Linux and Open Solaris are supported right now,
mm-hmm.
and so then what you can do is you can just say at any time you can make a web service call and say, hey Amazon, give me this kind of machine. They have several different classes of machines with different RAM and CPU.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, hey, give me this machine, and like a minute later, bam, it's there.
It's there.
And then when you're done with it, you just turn it off and you stop paying them. The great thing about it is that you pay per hour for this. So you can literally fire up infrastructure on demand and shut it down.
Yeah.
Right. When you buy servers, you have to recognize that over multiple years, because you're gonna you have to deal with the depreciation and all this.
3 year and whatever it
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
None of that with EC2. Just turn it on when you need it, turn it off when you're done. Bam.
That's phenomenal.
It's very straightforward.
Now, the machine images, are they all pre-canned images that Amazon puts together, or can you build your own seminal image and use it over
and
over again?
There's three types. Amazon makes some. They make sort of like they seeded the network with their own stuff, and then other people can make public images too that you can run, and then you can make your own.
That's fantastic, man.
Yeah, they're very flexible.
So you can easily have a MapReduce engine set up. You can have your master server. You had mentioned in our before talk that there's kind of the master engine and then all the different mapping and reducing engines, right?
Yeah, there's only one special type of node in a MapReduce network, and that's what's called the master. Mm-hmm. And the master is the job coordinator, right? It's going to tell all of the mappers where to find its data and then tell them where to notify the reducers when they're done, and then sort of coordinate the entire flow of the application. You know, restart failed mappers or reducers. And,
so do you have to have essentially three different types of configurations in a way, like the master and the mappers and reducers? Or you had mentioned
two. Yeah.
Because they can be either mappers or reducers when they run.
Actually, so they're dynamically allocated from the JVM. So it doesn't matter, right?
Okay.
In that regard, you know, in terms of the config. So what you essentially have is you have like one master and then N workers.
N workers, right.
Right, however many workers that you want.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Then, you know, so the mappers and reducers, the whole, the job scheduler, the task tracker, as it's called, will take care of all of that allocating here and there.
And can you join, the workers real time into the cluster as it's running?
That's right. Actually, if you start up any number of new Hadoop nodes and you just tell them where the master is, blam, they're immediately available for work.
So that's perfect, because with EC2, you can turn on, turn off,
exactly.
Increase the throughput, decrease the throughput,
exactly.
You know, if you're looking to save money.
Yeah, the especially with MapReduce, if that's all you need it for is MapReduce, you don't need it for the storage, you can literally plug in new, you know, additional computation on demand and not have to worry about, you know, paying more. And you just simply pay for what you use, and that's it. In fact, there's a story... you know, I don't want to make this an EC2 referendum, but it's sort of a great story about Hadoop and EC2 together. A guy at the New York Times, one of the devs, he was tasked with putting all of the New York Times archives online, right? And so that involved converting these files, like sort of some semi-expensive processing, you know. But you got to remember, the New York Times is from way back in 1870.
Yeah.
So this guy had 130...
a lot of data.
Exactly. This guy had 130 years of archives to put online, right?
Yeah.
So he went and put Hadoop on EC2 to work, and he did it in a day.
That's insane.
It cost him $200, and he put 130 years worth of archives of the New York Times online in a day for $200.
That is insane.
He fired up like a... I forget what they said, maybe 100 machines or something like that, you know, and just turn them on, you know, process, turn them off.
Here's our new CIO, you know.
But now here's the thing.
Right? That guy.
Imagine this compared to the other scenario, right? Now this guy spent $200 doing that, right? Like that's petty cash,
that's
right?
That's
like an expense, right? That's like an expensive dinner with five people, right? Now imagine that at a regular company where you'd have to call IT, servers provision.
Let's design the system.
Exactly.
Let's do the data model. Right. Let's load it into a data warehouse. That's the first thing you think of when you're processing a lot of data, right?
Exactly.
ETL in, all that garbage.
Yep.
So that's just a great story.
Yeah,
that's
phenomenal. There's a bunch of stories like that. And, you know, the ability to add computation on demand really is the power of Hadoop in the first place, because you know, you want to be able to scale. The whole design of the MapReduce system and the HDFS system is to be able to sustain failures by having nodes go down, and also to add new nodes when you need to increase capacity, because every node is the same. Like I said, there's only one special node, and that's the master. And so every other node is the same, so you can literally just plug new ones in. And with the dynamism that you get with EC2, plugging them in is just even more trivial than it ever was before.
And you had mentioned earlier before we started the show that if a node dies in the middle of processing, because there's kind of distributed file storage, you don't really lose that data, right?
Yeah, because HDFS is actually backed up either on disk with multiple replicas across multiple different machines, or it's backed up by Amazon S3. You don't have to worry about losing data if a node will go down.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the data is replicated to the point where you no longer care about individual node failure.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're
almost like
lose,
striping in a way or
yeah,
multiplexing,
it's actually very much like mirroring.
Okay,
it's very much like RAID 1, except it's done by default three times, and you can actually set it higher if you want.
Oh wow.
So you no longer care about random node failure. It's just not an issue. In fact, Google has a cool thing in their paper for MapReduce where they were running a job to test the sort of throughput of MapReduce, how fast it could go, and someone accidentally turned off 80% of the machines. No joke. Someone actually turned off 80% of the machines in the job.
That's great.
And the job still completed.
That's incredible.
Right, because that's how resilient it is. Because the map and the reducer are idempotent operations. You know, if some mappers or reducers fail, doesn't matter. Just restart them.
Right. Hey, it wasn't done yet. Some other worker pick it up.
Exactly. In fact, what happens is every once in a while, on really big clusters, you'll get machines that. Start to fail silently, start to corrupt things and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can go, their mappers and reducers can maybe go really slow. So what will happen is that at near the end of a job, and this can significantly extend the length of a job because the map phase has to be fully complete before the reduce phase
right.
can start.
So you get a slow mapper. Yeah.
Right. If one slow mapper can hold the whole thing up, so what the MapReduce tracker will do is actually spawn multiple copies of these map jobs at the end.
And it's a race.
And exactly. The first one win.
That's great.
That one's the one done. You just kill the rest. It's no problem. Because each one's doing the same work. It's the same output. It doesn't matter which one gets it done.
That's really a phenomenal platform.
Yeah.
Really is. So I guess the only drawback potentially for using EC2 is what if the lights go out, and it has happened a couple times now.
No,
so
EC2 is EC2 itself has never gone down. There was the one issue with the they had accidentally killed some of the instances.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of an administrative operations failure.
Right.
S3 though did
the file systems. Yeah.
Yeah. That S3 did have a sort of a very visible failure earlier last week. And so, definitely,
we're not knocking Amazon, but in general, cloud computing, we're having a fall conference coming up,
yeah.
right? So one of the questions with cloud computing is, what are the drawbacks? What should
right.
you be aware of? What kind of precautions should you take?
Yeah. When you're using EC2, in particular, because it is so flexible, you actually get, what amounts to a virtual private server on demand, as many as you want.
Yeah.
What amounts to that? So you do have to take great care in configuring these services, right? So you've got to bake a lot of stuff in, perhaps bake in some intelligence into the image that you make to sort of auto discover its environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come with that stuff baked in. There are some tools to help you. There's the EC2, what they call user data, which is available only to the instance, so you can sort of pass it a little bit of config.
Mm-hmm.
But you definitely have to worry about that because the server configuration is a big part of your service. Not every service is like Hadoop. It's not going to auto-discover. And so,
right.
If you're running web servers or things that need DNS, things that need DNS registration, things that are going to be hit from the outside, you have to do that all yourself.
Right, right.
So
you're still administering your boxes, or just virtual boxes.
Yeah, yeah. No, the administration challenge is real,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
EC2 works absolutely the best right now for machines that literally will start up, do a job, process work from a queue, and then just die when they're done, when there's
mm-hmm.
no work left, right? Because that yields the least configuration challenge. The high availability is not an issue, because if that one dies, you start up another one. They're totally orthogonal.
Mm-hmm.
And if the light goes out, no problem. We'll just do it later,
Right.
If you're trying to run a website, or a database on EC2, you're going to have some real challenges, because it's actually more challenging to run that on EC2 because the data, the disk on the machines is actually ephemeral.
Right.
Meaning
you shut down, it's gone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have to take great pains to back it up to S3 or someplace else or to another machine to do synchronous replication
mm-hmm.
to ensure that data is actually there.
Right.
Okay.
So some of your other interests. I was crawling around your site, the Cypher Blockchain Gang.
Yeah.
Is it just you and the Cypher Blockchain Gang?
Anymore, yeah. It's just me, yeah.
You had a collection of guys, and they broke free?
I had a thing with the... with. Back when I came up with the website, the web ring thing was really popular.
So, see, with the chain gang.
Yeah, I had a buddy make a little icon and everything. It was kind of cool. You know, we were in college. It was kind of fun.
CBCG.net is the website. And you have a blog going back to, what is it, 2003, 2004?
Yeah, something like that,
Yeah. So, and it looks like, you know, you're interested in there. You've talked a lot about other programming languages. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Erlang and Scala and Ruby.
Yeah.
What kind of languages make you get up and want to play with stuff today?
Mostly, you know, we're using Python and Java and Erlang, actually, a little bit, at Invite Media. And Erlang is really the one on my plate right now. Lisp, love Lisp, you know, Lisp and Scheme, love them.
But for real work and your world?
Well, you know, the thing about Lisp is that, like, I would be pretty comfortable writing, you know, Lisp code in production, right? But I would not be at all comfortable trying to find someone else who was comfortable working with that same stuff.
This is the Perl problem, right?
Yeah,
Perl.
Exactly, right.
I could do this in one line of Perl. It might be an entire page, but it's one long line. Yeah.
Right. No, Erlang is great because Erlang, like these, you know, sort of the new school, right? I mean, Erlang itself is very old, but it's very new school in its sort of philosophy. You know, crash-only software, fault tolerance built in, you know, totally message passing. So Erlang is a functional language, and as such, you cannot mutate any variable. Once you assign a variable, that's it. It cannot be reassigned. So I really actually dig that because a lot of the issues that come up with this sort of corruption, the really hard to find bugs, are because of this sort of implicit mutation that goes on in a regular imperative language.
Yes.
You know, and there are no locks to deal with, right? Because Erlang has a concept of process, but remember that, you know, you can only speak to another process by sending it messages. You cannot directly mutate the shared memory of a process like you can in Java threads or C threads or whatever.
So it's purely message-driven handoff.
Exactly,
there's nothing to lock, nothing to hold on to.
You just send a message.
That means you're done.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so there's no locks at all, right, which is great. And you can spawn up literally, you know, 80, 100,000 of these processes in a single Erlang VM. So they actually, when you have that many and they're that cheap, your style of solving problems actually becomes different. You know, you start thinking about communicating sequential processes and hierarchies of supervisory processes and whatnot. It's not only a fascinating language, but it's also extremely practical. Some of the best servers on the web are actually written in Erlang right now. RabbitMQ is an AMQP message broker, which is currently considered to be the sort of best written in Erlang. eJabberDee, you got to be insane to run an XMPP server that's not eJabberDee today. That's, like, clearly by far and away the best. Yaws is a web server and a sort of web and application server that just embarrasses Apache. Famous in the Erlang circles anyway.
Right.
There's this sort of famous graph of Joe Armstrong, the inventor of Erlang, had done a comparison between Apache and Yaws. And Apache, running on a regular file system, died at like 4,000 concurrent connections. Yaws, running on NFS, a shared file system, network file system, continued on processing at the same throughput levels, increasing throughput levels, rather, up to 80,000 concurrent connections.
Oh my.
On the same hardware.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So it's not quite so bad anymore, the gap, but it's still like just ridiculous, you know.
So Erlang, I got to look at Erlang now, huh?
Yeah, Erlang is definitely now I would say that the syntax is very off-putting to, you know, people who don't have a functional programming background.
Right.
And the pattern matching is probably even more off-putting than that. If you don't have a background in Prolog,
yes.
Erlang is going to look
very
strange.
You're tripping over yourself, yes.
Yeah, so, you know.
Interesting, though. So a problem that would be an obvious one to attack with Erlang might be what?
Any messaging platform.
Right.
You know, if you're writing an IM service.
Yeah, like eJabberDee you were mentioning, right?
Well, even an IM bot, you know, even something like Twitter actually runs eJabberDee on their edges for their XMPP agents. You could actually implement the entire of Twitter in eJabberDee without any sort of, like, you know, web or database thing. Actually, I think that's the way they should go, but, you know, they
they didn't hire me, so I don't, you know, right. Whatever.
We could make the Ruby guys mad and say, and then it wouldn't be in Rails anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, so Twitter's problems never had anything to do with Ruby or Rails.
Right.
They never
it's a scaling anything. Issue it's, with the hardware and everything else, right?
Issue. Yeah. I mean, they just literally, Twitter was just designed as a content management system.
Right.
And it really should have been a publish, subscribe, messaging system. And, you know, I don't fault anybody. Nobody knew it was going to be that big.
Right. It took off in ways just, that wasn't expected.
Exactly.
To.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, but Rails got this bad reputation for no reason. It had nothing to do with anything. Right. If it was written in Java, it would have been the same exact
Absolutely.
Thing.
So. Absolutely. I throw the T's out there just in case someone wants to complain. And then I also saw something else, and I'll wrap it up here, something about Comet.
Yeah, Comet is a web technology. It's not a technology. It's sort of a method mm-hmm. of doing bi-directional synchronous communication in real time over the web, right? As we all know, HTTP is stateless. You know, when you hit a request and you get a response, that's the end of the connection. So there are various sort of tricks and techniques to keep a connection open to the server, right? So AJAX allows you to make an asynchronous call back to the server without having to do a refresh, which is great, right? Allows a whole new level of dynamism, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when you want the server to be able to communicate back to the client asynchronously, like send it a note, hey, this email came in, or you got a message from a friend, or your friend just updated their photo on Flickr or Facebook. You know, you want those things to actually be notified asynchronously, because if you were to poll, that would put tremendous stress on your architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In fact, I was just reading a thing about XMPP PubSub yesterday, and it turns out that if you were to turn Flickr's entire feed into an XMPP stream, you could actually do the entire Flickr feed, all photos that were updated, like you know, on a given day, in less than 1 megabit.
Oh wow!
So you could take their entire firehose feed from Flickr on a DSL line from your house. So it's like that much more efficient. But the problem is HTTP doesn't support it. So Comet is a method, sometimes called reverse AJAX, to allow the server to be able to push down data to the browser asynchronously.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, there are various techniques to do that. Some involve Flash, some involve sort of hooks with JavaScript and things. But that's really essentially what it's for, making HTTP appear as if it were, you know, a bidirectional stateful connection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a neat technique, and you could do some really neat stuff with it, live chat. Google Talk actually uses Comet to do Google Talk IMing in the browser, as well does Facebook Chat. There's some really neat stuff you can do with it.
Great. All right. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming down. It was a very interesting talk, and talk to you at the fall conference.
Yeah, see you there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You can read about some of the technologies we covered today in our show notes page, which can be accessed at www.chariotsolutions.com/podcasts/techcasts/show notes. I'd also like to announce our upcoming conference. It's titled Fall Forecast, Computing Among the Clouds, and it's going to be held on Friday, October 17th, 2008, at the Penn State Great Valley Campus in Malvern, Pennsylvania. You can find out more information about the show, including speakers and registration information, at www.cloudconeast.com. That's cloudconeast.com. Find out more about Chariot Solutions, including our services, events, past presentations, and hiring information on our website, www.chariotsolutions.com.